Of all the human emotions, one of the most mysterious is our sense of wonder, that feeling of being overwhelmed by the sheer beauty and complexity of this planet and this life. So many things trigger wonder. Something as profound as standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon or seeing your newborn's face for the first time, or something as simple as just a shaft of light or a phrase of music. But what is wonder? It's a sensation that fuels the religious imagination, but it also drives scientific discovery. Steve Paulson joins us this hour to talk about the many connections between science and wonder. He's the executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge, Wisconsin Public Radio's nationally syndicated interview program. He's also the author of Adams and Eden, Conversations on Religion and Science. And full disclosure, he's also my husband. And Steve, this is the first time you've been on 45 North, so welcome to my studio.
It is. This definitely is a first, and I'm happy to be here.
I wanted to start by talking about your most recent piece on the history of wonder. You wrote an article for Nautilus magazine recently that drew this connection between wonder and the birth of modern science.
Right.
So tell us about it.
Well, Nautilus was putting together a whole issue on what they were calling the unlikely. So it's sort of the oddities of the world, oddities of nature. And they wanted to do a piece on how this played out in the history of science. And so my editor asked me if I'd like to interview this prominent historian of science, Lorraine Daston, who has written, who spent a lot of her career talking about how wonder has helped to sort of that exploration of wonder, how it led in some ways to the creation of modern science. And it's a fascinating story. And it goes—
Well, she writes a lot about monsters,
yes,
right?
Yes, so, and, well, this goes back to how she and a friend of hers back in grad school, Catherine Park, they realized that they were reading all of these great philosophers. And sort of back then, the philosophers and the scientists were kind of the same people back in the 17th century, people like Descartes and Leibniz and Roger Bacon, and they were called natural philosophers. There really wasn't sort of a science, a discipline of science back then. And they realized as they were reading all these people, they were all fascinated by what they would call the monstrous, by monsters. And, you know, examples would be two-headed snakes, conjoined twins, twins who are born at birth but are attached to each other. And so are they monstrous? Are they marvels of nature? And they were trying to sort this out. And there was this sense that they had to figure out these oddities of nature to really understand the laws of nature. So you had to sort of figure out the exceptions to be able to figure out how the laws of nature worked. And that drove a lot of the early science back then.
So you said Lorraine Daston and her friend mm-hmm. noticed that all these early natural philosophers were fascinated by weirdness,
right,
basically,
right. Yeah.
Monsters and yeah. weird anomalies. What did she do with that?
Well, she was interested in what people thought about these things, and so there was sometimes people found them terrifying. I mean, you know, two-headed snakes. I mean, this is weird. This is, you know, the stuff that today we would turn into science fiction. But then other people were also thinking, oh, these are marvels that are an expression of God's imagination. And so there was sort of this flipping often back and forth between is it monstrous? Is it terrifying? Is it a sign of the coming apocalypse? Or is it sort of a sign of God's majesty? And to put this in perspective, I mean, go back to the 17th century, so what, 400 years ago or so, there was no science back then. Science as we know it today did not exist. People were sort of making up the rules, and there was a sense that sort of the old thinking about science just didn't work anymore. And so there were no kind of working science as a discipline as we would have it today in a university. It really didn't exist. There were people who were doing science, people like Galileo, but as a discipline, it didn't work. So these people were making it up as they went, and they were trying to figure out not only what the rules of science were, but what the rules of nature were. And so they kind of had the sense that they had to explain these wonders to be able to figure out what nature was all about.
So what happened when Lorraine Daston began talking with her colleagues or her professors and saying, this is really interesting, how do you explain this?
They weren't interested. And so, and this is sort of this great academic story in a way. So she and her buddy, Katie Park, they thought, you know, no one else is talking about this, so we should write about it. So they wrote a scholarly article, which kind of got some attention, and they ended up spending years putting together a book, and it's this chronicle of this fascination with wonders back from the medieval age into about the 18th century. So, and it's this really interesting history of how people thought about this, and then also how it helped to shape modern science.
Well, you brought in some tape, didn't you, this morning? I can't talk to Steve Paulson without without hearing some audio tape. So what did you bring? Do we have a little bit of Lorraine Daffin?
We do have this. And so this will give a sense of how some of these are the greatest minds in Europe in the 17th century. And it will give some sense of how they approached the oddities of nature. So Lorraine Daffin.
In Descartes' case, he thought he could explain what was an old medieval marvel, namely the allegation that a victim of a murder would bleed again, the corpse would bleed again in the presence of the murderer or the murder weapon. Descartes thought he could actually explain this with his mechanical philosophy. Leibniz sent in to the Journal of the Paris Academy Royal of Sciences a report of a dog that could talk. It could bark out six words in French, including chocolat. So Galileo, when he went to Rome, made it a point to bring with him Bologna stone. Bologna stone is a phosphorescent mineral that glows in the dark to show off to the Jesuits. He described the four moons of Jupiter, which he discovered, as meraviglia, as marvels. Everybody was trafficking in marvels in the 17th century.
So your point, Steve, and Lorraine Daffin's point, I think, is that right there at the very birth of what we think of as modern science, there's a really core experience of wonder that drives everything. What is wonder?
Well, there are different ways to approach this. So there are wonders. So really what we're talking about there, I mean, what there was this fascination of the oddities, the irregularities of nature. There's also the experience of wonder itself, which is something different. It's kind of more of an emotional experience, and it probably has something to do with getting outside of ourself, sort of experiencing the larger world in some way, and, you know, just being struck by, wow, that's amazing.
So like in the introduction, I talked about, you know, that feeling standing in front of the Grand Canyon, or you and I hiked to the top of mountains, and that feeling when you come out of the trees and suddenly you're on the bald, bare top and you can just see forever. That feeling?
That's part of it. And probably the way I would experience it most sort of obviously would be in nature in some way. I mean, sort of some beautiful place where I just kind of get swept away by sort of this feeling. It could be in art. It could be seeing an amazing performance of a group of musicians. It could be, I mean, I've had the experience of going into art museums and just sort of seeing a painting that just kind of blows my mind. And it's sort of like, wow. And I think it's an experience. It's not just something that you kind of try to work out in some rational way. There's some kind of emotional experience there. And then there's another piece of this, which is related, and there's sort of an interesting history as well, awe. You know, so we tend to almost use those words interchangeably, wonder and awe, and they're somewhat different. I mean, historically, awe has a dimension of there's something scary about it. It can be terrifying. And so, again, going out to nature, it might be, you know, you'd go into the vast wilderness and it's like, wow, I mean, this is pretty amazing. This is overwhelming, but it's also, you know, am I going to get out of here alive?
Well, going back to the Grand Canyon, actually, I'm thinking, I remember standing the first time I ever saw the Grand Canyon. I'd seen it in tons of pictures and everything. And then standing right there on the edge of it and sort of feeling that space, it's what, a mile deep or something, feeling all that air and space, it's just terrifying. Or this summer, standing over Niagara Falls, right, when all that water goes shooting below you. Yeah, it's terrifying at the same time as stunning.
And there was a word that people used to talk about, and it's really kind of gone out of our vocabulary, the sublime, and which touches on some of these feelings of awe, which is, I mean, there's something fabulous about the sublime, but there's also something a little scary about it. And I mean, another example that I could imagine, I mean, I've never been to the Amazon rainforest, but I mean, from accounts that I've heard of people who've gone there, it seems overwhelming to go in there, sort of this, you know, teeming life. And, you know, it's the feeling of it's so much bigger. It's like you can't control it. It controls you. As Lorraine Daston at one point says in the interview I did with her, you don't have wonder. Wonder has you.
I love that. Well, that reminds me of another an interview you did, and I think you brought a clip from this in an interview with biologist Ursula Goodenough, because I think she doesn't she talk a bit about that?
She does. And so Ursula Goodenough is a very well-known cell biologist, and she wrote kind of a classic book called The Sacred Depths of Nature about 10 years ago or so. And she talks about this one transformative experience that she had when she was about 20. She was in college taking a physics class and really hadn't thought that much about kind of the big questions of life and meaning and all of that. And then she was out on a camping trip, and it all kind of came to a head. And you know, here's that bit of the conversation.
I suddenly realized that I was no longer thinking of this cute little round planet with a sky over it, that the whole thing was huge and immense and that the sun was going to go out. And I got very, very upset and disoriented and fearful, terrified, actually. And that stayed with me for a long time until I was able to work through it.
So how did you work through it?
Well, I realized that the real problem was that I was trying to find some point in it. And what I could do instead was to just realize that why there is anything at all, why the universe is here, why I'm here, is a mystery. And mysteries are not terrifying. They're just things that you don't understand. Once I did that, I could just take the whole story and take quarks and electrons and galaxies and everything and just say, okay, this is the way it is. Don't know why, but wow, it's pretty amazing. And lucky me to be a part of it.
Hmm. So you're saying this kind of scientific understanding, I mean, the more that you really get into the way life evolved, where the Earth came from, all of that, that really evokes for you profound feelings of awe and wonder.
You bet. I can't think of anything that even comes close.
And one of the things that's really interesting about Ursula Goodenough is she would be, I mean, if you were sort of to try to classify, so is she a religious believer or is she an atheist, you probably would say she's an atheist. She doesn't believe in God. But actually, she describes herself as a religious naturalist. So she is, I mean, she's a very prominent scientist, but she says that if you really are interested, if you're compelled to explore the ultimate questions of life, why are we here? You know, how did everything start? That is a sort of a religious orientation in a way. And yet she would describe herself as a naturalist, you know, doesn't believe in anything supernatural. And so it's kind of bridging these worlds of what you might call the scientific world, the rational world, and what traditionally have been some of the questions that the great spiritual thinkers have thought about.
Yeah, so what you're saying is those, what we think of as the ultimate questions, the big questions, have traditionally belonged to religion.
Right.
But it sounds like what you're saying is many contemporary scientists are kind of wanting to reclaim that territory.
Oh, and a lot of scientists have said that there's really no place for religion anymore. There's no place for philosophy anymore. So Stephen Hawking came out with a book a couple of years ago where he said that philosophy is dead because it has not caught up with recent developments in science. And you can sort of look at a lot of the different fields in science, whether it's cosmology and study of the origins of the universe, or neuroscience, how the brain works and how the connection between the brain and the mind. I mean, a lot of those were those ideas, you know, what the mind is all about. Those used to be what philosophers and religious thinkers were obsessed about. Now they're very much in the domain of science. And so that's part of this tension between science and religion in today's life.
Well, and going back to wonder, I mean, that experience of wonder that we're, you know, trying to kind of describe, that feeling of awe and transcendence and just being suffused with an experience of beauty, something bigger than you, those are all experiences that traditionally we've called religious or
right.
mystical experiences.
Right.
So can those feelings also grow directly out of science?
And that's a really interesting question. And I've asked a bunch of scientists about that because this is one of those questions that I love to ask scientists. And E.O. Wilson is one of the people I talk with.
The great
the
ant
great
biologist,
the great ant biologist, one of the greatest living biologists, and he would say that wonder is very much a motivation for why he does what he does. And the way he talks about it is, he would say, you know, when he's looking at his ants, you know, he's out in the fields, he says, you know, it makes me think that it makes me marvel at the history of the universe and the history of evolution. You know, I have to think about, you know, the formation of stars and galaxies, and, you know, how Earth came to be, and then how life evolved on Earth, and sort of, you know, eventually the niche that ants developed within this evolutionary history. And he says that fills him with a greater sense of awe and wonder than anything that he got from his religious upbringing. He grew up a Southern Baptist in the South, and he says, you know, it's the science that – so that's sort of what – so it would be a much more of a kind of an analytical approach. And then there are other scientists who say, no, it's – yeah, the science can help you get there, or maybe the wonder sparks your interest in some of these things, but ultimately wonder is an emotional experience.
Hmm. Well, Steve, I wanted to talk with you about wonder because, you know, we're heading into the weekend, and I think of weekends as a time when we recharge, and part of that recharging and restoring ourselves from the busy week is sometimes to try to reclaim that the part of us that does feel wonder from time to time. So when we come back, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk about how to cultivate a sense of wonder. And if you are listening, question to you, what is the most powerful experience of wonder you've ever had? Call and share your experience with us. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us if you're shy. It's talk@wpr.org. We're talking about wonder with Steve Paulson, executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge, author of Adams and Eden, Conversations on Religion and Science. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and you're listening to 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about wonder with Steve Paulson. He's the executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge, author of Adams and Eden, Conversations on Religion and Science. And he is also, full disclosure, my husband and colleague on To the Best of Our Knowledge. And Steve, you know, it's easy to talk about wonder in the abstract. I think the challenge is to make it visceral. Is there an experience of wonder that you've had that you could describe?
Yeah, I've had several. I've had a couple of, I would say, sort of big experiences of wonder, and they've happened outdoors in incredibly beautiful places. So one was years ago in Hawaii on the island of Kauai. I was hiking in the Waimea Canyon before I ever knew you, and it just sort of hit me that it's just like, wow, this is so. I mean, it wasn't even so amazing. I wasn't sort of thinking about it in those ways, and sort of I had this overwhelming feeling of everything was right in the world, and it's just it sort of lost sense of myself in some way. I was just part of this larger. I wasn't even thinking about me. I was just sort of reveling in being part of this glorious universe. And
so the boundaries of yourself
right.
are dissolved.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly. And you know, when people describe mystical experiences, I mean, that's often one of the things they say, and it's sort of the classic religious mystical experiences. You lose your sense of self, and you know, it's something much larger than that. And I don't really think of this in religious terms, but I'm sure that there's a lot in common there between that kind of experience in nature and what, say, a spiritual mystic would talk about.
Well, let's take a couple of calls. We've got Adam on the line from Dunn. Hi, Adam. How are you?
Good. How are you doing today?
Okay. Thanks for calling. Do you have a wonder experience to share?
Yeah. One of the most wondrous moments of my life occurred when I was visiting the coast of Oregon, and we were near Newport, and it was nighttime, and we walked down to the beach. And you could see that there's a twinkling all over the sand. And when you look down, whenever you walk in the sand, it twinkled all around you. And later we learned that it was bioluminescent bacteria that occurs there in the tides every so often.
Wow.
And then even as you looked out into the ocean, as the waves broke and as the clouds came in, you could see twinkling and kind of it looked like neon green waves. And so I was just kind of blown away for a couple minutes, just kind of asking everyone, do you see what I'm seeing?
It must have felt like the stars in the sky came down to Earth, and you could walk on them.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, thank you so much. That's just beautiful. Thanks. And we've also got Janet is calling from Maquantico. Hi, Janet.
Hi.
Do you have an experience of wonder to share?
Well, it's an experience of my granddaughter, who's 4, and it's a reminder of how children see things we become used to seeing. She saw a beautiful sunset and was overcome, and she started tearing up, and she told her mom that her eyes were drooling, and that she said, "It's not because I'm sad. It's like when you go to a wedding and you're so happy and you cry or you know." So I thought that was just her awareness, perhaps for the first time, of this beautiful sunset.
Oh, that's really lovely. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. You know, I was thinking, Steve, a lot of what we're talking about, I think many of us remember powerful first experiences of wonder from when we were children.
Yeah.
You know, maybe children, I don't know, are they more open to these experiences, do you think?
Yeah, I do think so. Because really, wonder is about seeing the world with fresh eyes. It's being open to new experiences. And I mean, obviously, we all can do this. I mean, adults can do this, but I think it's easier for children. In fact, there's another clip that I brought in with Neil deGrasse Tyson, the well-known astrophysicist who's director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York City. And he describes his own experience of wonder, which really shaped his life. And maybe we could go ahead and talk about this. So he's describing this early childhood experience that he had.
There's this odd room. It's round with a hemispherical ceiling and this creature-looking piece of hardware in the middle of the room. And the light's dim. And you don't know what that thing is going to do. Is it going to come out and attack you? But then the splendorous night sky appears above your head. And I was born in the Bronx, New York, where I pretty much thought I'd seen all the stars visible. It was about 11 stars at night. And here were thousands. And in fact, I thought it was a hoax at first. I would later recognize that, of course, that was the real sky, and I was starstruck, really, by it. And I would say that my path to become an astrophysicist wasn't even my choice. I was called by the universe, and that was my first true encounter with what I would call wonder.
Huh. How old were you when that happened?
I was 9.
That's astonishing. I mean, you now run the Hayden Planetarium.
Yeah.
What do you think happened during that experience when you were 9? Was it just how overwhelming it all was? How surprising?
Exactly. And I've later done some research on this as director of the planetarium. And what we found, in order for an exhibit to make a completely indelible mark, it's got to be bigger than you are. You have to turn your head up and down, left and right, to see what's going on. And there are sounds and smells, and you're transported. What we don't appreciate as adults regarding kids is that they are persistently and perennially curious. And it's really forces of society that kind of squash that curiosity.
So how do you think we can inspire that sense of wonder in kids, specifically through science?
They already have the wonder. My worry is, how do we get that sense of wonder back in the adults? The kids are not the problem here.
Huh.
It's adults run everything. The kids are already curious about the natural world. And left to themselves, they will explore it, period. So the real task of the adult is to get out of their way.
So what happens in school then? Because so many kids are turned off of science in elementary school.
Holding aside that they might have just simply had a bad teacher, the good student in class is the one who obeys the teacher, who is not disrupting. And that is like the opposite of curiosity and wonder. Curiosity and wonder is, I have this energy, it's gurgling within me, I've got to express it somehow. I think this sit down, shut up, learn and take an exam is incommensurate with cosmic discovery.
That is so interesting. That was Neil deGrasse Tyson, but he really links curiosity and wonder. Is that a theme that you saw coming up in a lot of your interviews?
It is. And again, there's an interesting history there because they're different things. I mean, curiosity and wonder. Curiosity can often spark wonder, or wonder can spark the urge to find out about stuff. And again, historically, curiosity was it was not something that was necessarily valued back 300 or 400 years ago. go back much longer, the story of Adam and Eve. I mean, what is that? That's a cautionary tale about the dangers of curiosity. You know, beware tasting the from the
forbidden fruit from the tree of knowledge.
Exactly. Wisdom. I mean, that was you weren't supposed to do that. And so take jump ahead to should you be questioning religious authority? Should you be questioning the all-powerful prince where you might be living? And so one of the leaps that had to happen to get to the birth of science was to embrace curiosity, to dare to explore the unknown, because that was kind of considered—you weren't supposed to do that 500 years ago.
It's interesting because you were talking about curiosity and wonder, and the thing that kept coming to my mind in listening to Neil deGrasse Tyson talk about children is I flashed on I'm an inveterate collector. Like if we're on a beach or a seashore or something, any place, if there are pebbles, if there are shells, whatever there is to collect, I will try to collect. And I think those collecting experiences are often the ones that have sparked the most sense of wonder for me. I don't know, is that something that has also come up in what you've read about the connection between collecting and wonder?
Oh, there's a fascinating history here. Again, going back to the interview that I did with a historian of science, Lorraine Daston, it harkens back to what were called the Wunderkammern, that's been usually translated as the cabinets of curiosity.
Like cabinet of wonder would be better.
It's actually the more accurate translation. And I mean, there was a rage for these cabinets of curiosity back in especially the 17th century or so. And it was all the weird stuff that was being collected. So it could be everything from a two-headed snake to some of the natural creatures that were being brought into Europe from around the world. This is the sort of the great age of global commerce. So it might be birds of paradise or armadillos or man-made objects, paper money from China. That was considered so weird. And all of this stuff was put into the same rooms. And so the great princes, this would be their pride and joy, would be to have these cabinets of wonder. And they would invite the visiting ambassadors and look at my power, look at my glory. And when you think about it, these were really the ancestors of the modern museum. I mean, these early cabinets of curiosities.
Steve, you have a cabinet of curiosity. I just realized I'm thinking about your book collection. Overflows everywhere. It's your wonder cabinet.
I'm a bit of a hoarder when it comes to books. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that's really interesting to think about this. So going back to the cabinets of curiosities, this was all about the oddities of nature or the oddities that were man-made. I mean, that's what people collected back then. And I think there's been a shift in how people think about wonder now, which is it's not necessarily the strange stuff, it's the ordinary. And that's really kind of what I think that's kind of our task in life right now, is to find the marvelous in the everyday, in ordinary experiences. And can I actually I came across a great quote from Rachel Carson. Can I read that for you?
Yes.
So Rachel Carson, of course, is one of the greatest environmentalists of the last century, best known for her classic book, Silent Spring, published in the early 60s, warnings about the dangers of DDT. She was also fascinated by wonder, and she wanted to write a big book about wonder, and she died before she could do that. But she wrote an essay, which then was later turned into a small book called The Sense of Wonder. And this harkens back to one of our callers. It's all about going out onto the seashore, into the woods, with her 2-year-old grandnephew and sort of experiencing the world from his point of view, experiencing wonder. You know, it's sort of like touching moss in a forest after a rainstorm and just feeling what that was like. And she has this one quote, which I just love. She said, "If I had the influence with the good fairy who was supposed to preside over the christening of all children, I should ask that her gift to each child in the world be a sense of wonder so indestructible that it would last throughout life as an unfailing antidote against the boredom and disenchantments of later years, the sterile preoccupation with things that are artificial, the alienation from the sources of our strength."
Oh, that's beautiful.
She wrote that in the 1950s.
Wow. That's just beautiful. I was also thinking, I brought a quotation of my own. I was thinking of Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said, "The mark of wisdom is to see the miraculous in the common."
Yeah.
Going back to the wonder in the mundane. We've got another caller I wanted to get to. Anne is on the line from Sheboygan. Hi, Anne.
Hi. What a great conversation. Thanks for having it. It's so upbuilding for a Friday morning.
Well, thanks for calling. Did you have an experience to share?
Yeah, absolutely. I was a very young mother for the first time, and when I held my daughter for the first time, I was so scared about all that that meant to be a new mom and how scary it was. But as I was holding her on my chest for the first time and watching her move and feeling her move, it filled me full of wonder when I was able to kind of recognize those feelings already. I felt like, you know, I know these movements. I know these feelings. I've already felt her with these movements inside of me before. And I was overstruck with wonder when I felt those movements with her outside of my body and holding her and knowing that it's going to be okay. We're both going to be fine. It was a moment I still remember as just filling me full of wonder.
Oh, that's beautiful. As a mother myself, you're taking me right back. I remember that being pregnant and feeling one of my babies move inside. It's an extraordinary. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that. Steve, that actually hit me so much. I'm having trouble remembering what I was going to ask you next.
Well, and I think, I mean, if we talk about, so I mean, one of the questions we're asking here is, how do you cultivate a sense of wonder in mm-hmm. today's world? And there are probably various ways to do it. One would be, I mean, one of my ways would be to, you know, get out of my routines and go into the woods, or I like to ride my bike, and I go through the Arboretum here near where I live in Madison, and to see the wild turkeys there, or, you know, there's sort of these, you know, occasional there. I saw the other day, like a big buck just wandering along the road there, and I thought, wow, that is pretty amazing. Or it's just trying to, and I have to kind of work at this a little bit, it's trying to, when I'm walking the dog in the morning, it's sort of, you know, I tend to walk the same way, or I have a couple of different routes, to try to look at the houses, the trees, in a slightly different way. It's almost to sort of try to put on new eyes, in a way, just to sort of look at things. And, you know, if I think about it, I can do that.
Yeah, which is sort of ironic, isn't it? Because we're talking about one of the most powerful experiences we can have, which often arrives almost unbidden. You know, you think of it as just a gift. But what you're suggesting is, no, you can also deliberately try to cultivate it, deliberately try to open yourself to, I mean, remind yourself of what's wondrous that's all around you.
And I think to some degree, it's sort of making a real effort to not overthink everything, just to kind of experience through your senses. I mean, so what you see, what you feel, what you touch, and just to be more deliberate about that.
Well, there's that, and there's also, I think, that quotation from Rachel Carson, the thing I found so powerful about it is even back in the 1950s, she was talking about our feeling of the sterility of modern life, the feeling of being alienated, the feeling that something about our daily existence disenchants us.
Right.
And I think what you're talking about is kind of having to pay attention to do the work of re-enchanting your own life, because, you know, let's face it, most of us get up in the morning, we turn on the news or pick up a newspaper, and it's depressing by and large. I mean, I don't think you can read a newspaper, put it down, and still feel much of a sense of wonder. So I guess what you're saying is it's kind of our responsibility to try to re-enchant our own lives.
Yeah, I think so. And I think you can do it in a lot of different ways. So, I mean, we've been talking a lot about going out into nature, and there are other ways. There are, I mean, I was saying earlier, you could have that experience with a work of art. You could, maybe with a book.
Music,
absolutely. Music can sweep you away, and it's taking you beyond yourself in a way.
We have a time for one more quick call. Jane is calling from Oshkosh. Hi, Jane.
Hello.
Hi. Do you have an experience of wonder to share?
Oh, yes, another one going out into nature. A couple years ago, we went out to Nebraska in March for the annual crane migration, and just being totally surrounded by just thousands and thousands of cranes within feet of you, it was just awesome.
Oh, thank you. That just sounds beautiful. And, you know, we've been talking so much about wonder and nature, and Steve, I'm struck by how many of the scientists you talked with are wildlife biologists or people who work with the natural world, yeah. biologists of some sort or another. Yeah. Is there one more you brought in?
There is, actually. This is an older interview I did with Brute Galdikas, and she is one of the pioneering women who did an amazing study of orangutans. And so she was really the first person to ever go out into the field and do an extensive long-term study of orangutans in Borneo, in one of the most remote parts of the world. And she talks about what it was like to look into the eyes of an orangutan and to have the animal look back into her eyes.
It's almost like finding God. It's a powerful moment of transcendence. It's suddenly you realize that you're not alone in the universe. And those moments were very, very powerful. And of course, they came from the fact that there was total, absolutely total isolation. And they came out of the fact that there was total acceptance on the part of the orangutans, and possibly on my part as well, of the situation. And those moments had the intensity of a religious experience. The setting does reflect, you know, the kind of setting that we have in Gothic cathedrals or in mosques. There's sort of these beams of light, you know, that shoot from the sky, and there's a sort of a hush and a quiet. And I think that what churches try to do is they try to duplicate, you know, the ancient forest from which we came. And so, like, when you go into the forest, it's like going into a church, but not into a church created by humans, into the original church, into the original, you know, Garden of Eden, which was our home, which is where we became human. These kinds of experiences help explain why people frequently become almost addicted to helping certain species or become addicted to nature. It's because they find something there that they can find no place else.
What a beautiful quotation. That was Brute Galdikas, the great orangutan wildlife biologist. You know, it just strikes me, Steve, that until fairly recently, you would never have heard a scientist talking like that.
No, and more do now. And one thing that's interesting is there are more and more scientists who are not remotely religious who also want to reclaim the sense of wonder. Basically to say wonder is not just a religious experience. And a good example would be Richard Dawkins.
Oh, one of the most famous atheists in the world.
Absolutely. And, of course, you know, he gets criticized a lot. And, you know, one of the old criticisms from religious believers about atheists is, oh, you know, you're kind of removing all sense of meaning from the world. And someone like Dawkins would say, no, actually, what I do is I look for it through the wonders of what I'm learning about science. In fact, he has a memoir that's going to be coming out in a couple of months, and the title of it is An Appetite for Wonder, The Making of a Scientist.
What a great title.
And so what he's saying is you don't need any kind of religious framework to experience the wonders of the natural world, and that's what fills him with, I don't know if he would use the word meaning, but certainly with a sense of fulfillment of what is marvelous about living in this world.
Is that part of why you've been so interested in interviewing so many scientists for the last few years? Because that's where you find a sense of wonder?
Yeah, that is. And I'm sort of trying to work it out. I mean, I think one of the sort of the questions that we're trying to wrestle with right now is, you know, science is really to some degree the reigning intellectual framework of modern life anymore, as more and more people have left traditional religion. So what's left? And it's to figure out where you can find spiritual sustenance, but not in any kind of traditional religious way. So where do the scientists look? I mean, they often look to that sense of wonder in the natural world.
Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, a pleasure.
Steve Paulson, executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge, author of Adams and Eden, Conversations on Religion and Science, also has a new article about wonder and the birth of science out in Nautilus magazine. You'll find a link on our Facebook page at 45 North on WPR. When we come back, To the Best of Our Knowledge producer Sarah Nix put together a recent hour-long show on wonder. One of my favorite pieces was an interview with contemporary artist Janet Cardiff. We'll be talking with her after the break. I'm Ann Strainchamps. You're listening to 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio. Can you make wonder, create it deliberately? That's the task the international sound artist Janet Cardiff sets herself when she begins a new piece, and she joins us this morning. Janet, I wanted to begin by asking you if you would walk us into your 40-part motet, kind of be our virtual guide.
Well, quite often when you're walking into the piece of the motet, you start hearing the singers before you even enter the space, and so you're wondering, what is there? There's a choir in this room? When you walk into the room, there's stands with 40 speakers set up in an oval around the space. And as you walk up to one of them, each one is a separate singer. So you really get a sense that that speaker somehow has the spirit or the ghost of this particular singer. You know, the anthropomorphic sense of that that speaker is an absent person. The 40-part motet is a what I call a reworking of Thomas Tallis's Speminalium, which was a piece of music written in about 1573. It's an incredible 40-part harmony piece, and when I heard it on just a two-track system, I thought immediately that, oh, wouldn't this be beautiful as 40 different separate speakers? So a lot of technical innovation afterwards by my partner George Burzmiller and I, and we recorded a choir in England. We finally got the system played back onto 40 separate speakers. And it's quite fascinating to watch people because they sort of walk in quickly and all of a sudden they go into slow motion and their faces have this sense of, oh my goodness, what is this? And then they slowly walk into the center of the oval and they stand there. And then you hear the breath of the first choir going, and then they start with Speminalium.
Gorgeous music to begin with, but the experience must be like being in the middle of Renaissance polyphony on steroids.
For me, it was a kind of interesting piece to do because I was very interested in having this up-to-date technology playing back a 16th century piece of music. You can follow the music as it goes from one choir to another and to another. You could hear it moving around in a sculptural way. I just love the feeling of sound coming from one side, then another crosses over you to another, and so all those sound waves hitting your body. It's quite an effect.
People must cry.
Yeah, it's an interesting effect because you see people and they do burst out crying, or they just sit there, and they sit there maybe for two versions through. And I remember watching a three-year-old conduct them, the whole choir, that which was wonderful too. And people lie on the floor. There might be 20 people in this space, but they're all staring into somewhere, whether it's an interior space in their minds.
You were talking about wonder in this hour. Mm-hmm. Your work in this piece in particular seems to me to be all about creating an experience of wonder. Is that something you think about consciously when you're creating a piece?
I think wonderment in our work is something that we really concentrate because we love to experience it. And we make work so that we can feel it. And so many of our pieces have this sense, whether it's through trickery of technology or playfulness, it gives you a sense of, wow, how did they do that? Or all of a sudden you realize that you're in one space in your mind and in physical reality, you're all in different spaces, and your mind kind of goes through this point where it can't concentrate, and so it goes into a state of wonderment, I think. And that is very important to me because I'm almost political in my views that the art that I want to create should be transcendent.
Is there something contradictory about setting out deliberately to try to manufacture wonder or an experience of wonder? Because I think of the experience of wonder as a kind of cosmic gift.
Well, I think there's so many different definitions of wonder, right? If it's the wonder that you get when you watch a magician, that's wonderment. But it's also, I was just in the Prado Museum in Madrid and looking at the paradise of earthly delights by Hieronymus Bosch. And people were all standing around just going, how did someone create this world? So I think artists deliberately do that because we enjoy it. And I don't think wonderment, it comes naturally in the physical world, of course, but I think it's quite fine if it's manufactured.
We should talk about some of your other pieces. I mean, you've become really well known for the audio walks you've created all over the world. Tell me about the one in London's East End.
There's always kind of a bit of a narrative behind some of the audio walks. And the narrative behind this is that this woman is invisible and lost in London. She's walking around, but she's listening to a tape recording she did herself from years ago. But you also hear the character, the woman, which is my voice, giving you instructions as you move around, and she's listening to her past voice.
You can see the church steeple, scaffolding, graffiti on the wall, barbed wire, broken windows.
But then you start embroidering. You know, new stories come up, things happen, and after a while, honestly, I was just sitting in my office listening to this, and I got this strange feeling that I wasn't entirely sure where I was.
Yeah. I think people get very much in a trance when they do the pieces. And the reason I try to have them at the right place at the right time is that things sync up. Like I'll say, there's a lime green car parked across the street. And I knew that was a painter, Chris Ophelia's apartment right there. And I knew he has a lime green car, and it was quite often there. So then when people were doing it, Chris told me later, he'd looked out the window and he'd see people stop, and just the look on their face was like, oh my God, how'd that car be there? And she knows it's there, and this is the past. So I'm manufacturing these kinds of synchronicities. I see them as how you put poetry together. You put images of sound.
I'm curious about, you know, out of all of the media you can use, and you trained as a visual artist first, you use sound. Why is that? I mean, do you feel like sound takes us places, offers us something that the other senses don't?
Well, definitely. When I started working with sound, I just felt like, yes, it felt just right. You can still work with visuals. You create the visuals in the people's brains. For me, it's a medium that can go into people's minds in a way that is non-intellectual.
I imagine viewers must respond very differently. And of course, your work has been seen in many different countries. You've got installations up in Sweden and Brazil and Canada, all over the place. Do you find that people respond differently? You know, some people are readier to play.
I definitely do. It's interesting you say that because we've had a lot of success in Germany. And Germans have a huge sense of curiosity. I think curiosity in the viewers, in the audience, is very important. We found that some pieces don't go over in America because there's such a short attention span. People, when they go to museums, sometimes want the answer right away, or they want something right away. They don't want to wait 20 minutes for a piece to unfold itself and then have to think about it. Whereas a lot more, I think in Europe, people are much more open to that. And I shouldn't say that generally, because we've had lots of work in America and the Americas. It's all been pretty successful. But I do notice when we have shows and there's New Yorkers coming in, you know, they're texting while they're listening to 40-part motet or something.
Janet Cardiff is an installation artist who lives and works in Germany and British Columbia. There's a video clip of one of her sound walks on our Facebook page if you want to get a sense of what they're like. And don't forget to friend us while you're there. It's 45 North on WPR.
Thanks this week to our producers, Rhonda Fanning and Marika Saval, and to the woman in charge, Jennifer Dargan. We had technical direction this week from Dave Potraz and Brittany True. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk again next week.